So I'm delighted that you're here tonight, and I'm particularly pleased that my friend and colleague, Archbishop Lazar Puhalo, is able to be here and to kick this off for us. He has occasionally regaled me with his stories of political activism in the late 50s and 60s. He has had a bit to do with political parties that span the whole spectrum in Canada. He has had a deep concern for public life in our country, and I think a wonderful and interesting way of understanding the place of religion in that, with all of its diseases and with all of its genius. So I'm delighted he's here this evening to open this up for us. I've asked him to speak to the theme for half an hour or so, and then I'm pleased that Professor Peter Mariowski is going to be a respondent for us tonight to begin to open up the conversation, respond to him for 5-10 minutes, whatever is his pleasure, and then we'll talk together. And all of you will, no doubt, I trust, be interested in entering into the conversation. So, Archbishop Lazar, religion, a strength and a weakness for political parties.
Okay. I'm supposed to sit here.
Welcome.
Yeah. I suppose.
You're there, standing with you, you're alive. In more ways than one.
They have a little thing where they can push a button and blow me up if I get out of hand. I think that's what he's talking about. Could you hear out there? Before I suppose, enter directly into the subject, I'd like to at least examine where I'm coming from. This modern phrase we have, where I'm coming from on the subject. A little bit of the background of it, because being Eastern Orthodox, we've had a very long experiment with state churches and what we used to like to think was a symphony between church and state. When Emperor Constantine recognized that Christianity had de facto become a dominant force in the empire, so far as religion goes, he could never have conceived of there not being a state religion. Nobody in the classical world could have conceived religion that wasn't a state religion, that wasn't somehow the spiritual guardian of the state. The emperors had considered themselves divine, which is the root of our idea of the divine rights of emperors and kings. And consequently, in this transition, it was inevitable that the emperor should seek to have a state church or state religion that would replace the old pantheons. And the working out of the relationship between the church and the state took quite a considerable time. The Emperor Constantine called the First Ecumenical Council largely because he wanted order in the empire. You had a lot of Gnostic Christian religions around, and some divisions in Christianity, and the Emperor Constantine didn't want that kind of disorder in his empire. And probably quite sincerely, he wanted the Christians to get together and resolve what was the faith. So the ecumenical councils, and most of you are vaguely at least familiar with the with at least seven of the ecumenical councils, could only be called by the emperor and on the authority of the emperor to debate the matters of religion and doctrine. In fact, we've often had the discussion in the Orthodox Church, could there be another ecumenical council since there's no emperor to call an ecumenical council? And how would we get around that problem of convention? So the church and state tried to work out what they called a symphony. The church had its sphere of responsibility, the state had its sphere of responsibility, and the state was never to try to dictate doctrine or dogma or what the essence of the faith was. The faith, on the other hand, was not supposed to interfere with the imperial government. And to a certain degree it worked, but in so many areas it didn't work. When, for example, Emperor Theodosius committed a kind of an outrage and murdered or put to death a lot of people in Thessaloniki because of a riot, and then proceeded to go on to the city of Mediolanum, of Milan, St. Ambrose, the bishop of Milan, met him at the door of the church and forbade him to enter until he repented. And the aide-de-camp to the emperor said, I'd never heard a bishop speak to an emperor that way. And the emperor replied, then you've never met a Christian bishop before. So he did go away and repent before he could enter the church. Ambrose knew very well that it was in the spiritual best interest of the emperor's salvation for him to repent and cleanse himself of the blood of these people that he had murdered. And he wasn't going to sacrifice the emperor's salvation, nor was he going to let him defile the church with the blood on his hands. And so with both considerations, the emperor stopped him from entering, the bishop stopped him from entering the church. So you had these little collisions along the way. Eventually, the emperor preempted for himself the right to appoint the Patriarch of Constantinople, the Archbishop of the city, who was the senior church authority in the Eastern Roman Empire. And at this point, the symphony begins to break down a little. When you try to work out an actual symphony between church and state, the state always demands more than it gives and receives more than it gives and uses the church for its own purposes and ends. After the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire, what you sometimes call the Byzantine Empire in the West, the fall of the empire, the Byzantine Commonwealth continued, Russia, Romania, the Romanian principalities, the emerging Serbian state and others, would continue to have this idea of the symphony between church and state. Only now the Turks had taken over much of the Balkans, and they recognized the position of the church in relation to the state, and the bishops then became what are called ethnarchs. They were responsible for the behavior of the enslaved peoples, and they would answer with their lives if people got out of hand in a political way. So this relationship then under the Turks placed the bishops in a political position as representatives of the central government, the Turkish government. In Russia, the imperial government also tried to continue this symphony between church and state, and it also worked to a certain degree until Ivan the Terrible. In the time of Ivan the Terrible, as you may know from history, Ivan was something of a mass murderer who would go down and burn whole cities and murder the entire inhabitants and that sort of thing. The patriarch of the time, St. Philip, tried to stop him. He tried to put a halt to these murders, to this killing. So he was interfering in the state because he was trying to stop the state from committing these outrages, or the emperor from committing these outrages. The emperor responded by sending a man named Skuratov to murder the patriarch. A little later, Emperor Peter I decided to abolish the patriarchate and incorporate the church into the state mechanism. So he created the same number of ranks in the church as there were in the military, the same number of ranks in the civil service as there were in the military. So there were the same number of ranks in the church, the civil service, and the military, and tried to really incorporate the church as a department of the state itself. There was a ministry of religion, an Oberprocurator of religions, who was very often an atheist, in the case of the Galicians. And so the symphony broke down, and the state simply tried to utilize the church for its own ends. Some people don't realize that the Orthodox Church was persecuted by a number of the Tsars, a number of the Russian emperors, for refusing to change the doctrine of the church for the sake of the state. And in the time particularly of Alexander I, a number of bishops were sent into exile, were imprisoned and driven out of their centers for refusing to compromise the faith with the state. So when the communist regime came along, the church, well, of course, it functioned as for the salvation of the people, for the acquisition of the Holy Spirit, nevertheless was in a position where the communist government simply marched in and took over the imperial government, just as the Turks had taken over the government of Constantinople. And again, the bishops would either operate as, in a way, agents of the state, or they would be exterminated. In the first few years, most of the bishops were killed or sent to Solovki prison camp on the White Sea, where life expectancy was 3 years. Many of them were sent to the far north of Siberia. In any case, the great struggle between the church and the state, in which the state was totally dominate, as it was in pagan Roman times with the early church. And so the Christians had to live by means of martyrdom. So this symphony between church and state always worked in favor of the state, seldom ever worked in favor of the faith. The same was true in Romania, in Bulgaria, in Yugoslavia, and all the other, Czechoslovakia, all the other Eastern European countries. The communist central government, in order to have complete control, had to deprive people as best it could of another way of thinking and of the internal spiritual freedom that they received from the faith. Because so long as people had that internal freedom, they might be dangerous. They might think in other ways. They did the same in the Islamic areas of the Russian Empire. The Jews, the same way. You couldn't allow people these alternate ways of thinking or this internal freedom that they might have. So when I look at the relationship between church and state and the involvement of the church in political parties or the involvement of political parties in the church, this is the background that I have to speak from, because this is what I'm intimately familiar with, and I'm familiar with the ongoing problems of having a church state in the Republic of Greece today. Fortunately, none of the Eastern European countries has opted to recreate a state church. The church has somehow been liberated from this bondage to the state, and yet has a great deal of influence in the state because it's woven into the fabric of the culture of the various nations. In, we won't speak for Europe, but in North America, where so much of the fabric of our society was woven by both political theory and by the faith, by religion. In Canada, more by the Anglican Red Tory tradition, which John A. MacDonald and John Diefenbaker and others followed, was really to a great degree a product of Anglican religious political theory. Of course, the ultramontane Roman Catholic Church in the province of Quebec had a great deal to do with the integration of Quebec into Canada, because it was ultramontane and not centered on France. It was centered on Rome, and it didn't have the same political ramifications. So Canada and the United States both had fairly radically different formations in the relationship between church and state. We didn't, in Canada, go to some great extent to try to separate church from state. It wasn't a major campaign of some kind. It wasn't something that people felt was extremely urgent to do. In creating a democratic society, we naturally did not opt for a state church of one kind or the other. But at the same time, Canadians did not show the great concern for the separation of church from state that was showed in the United States. So, for quite a long while in the beginning of Canada, we had ways where the clergy could influence the state. We also had times when the courts ruled against the church's involvement in politics. There was a case in Quebec, which I can't cite at the moment because I don't remember it in detail, where the clergy, Roman Catholic clergy, campaigned for the people to vote in a certain way. And the loser of the election challenged the election in court because the church had a special kind of control over the people. There could be the idea that if you didn't vote the right way, you might go to hell, or you might lose your soul, or you might be trapped in purgatory for some length of time. Consequently, this kind of influence that people had, that the church could actually have this kind of fear, or a weapon of fear, to push people to vote the way they wanted to, was disallowed by the church. So they had to have the election had to occur again, had to be rerun. And so what do we do now in our time, in our place, when people are relatively skeptical of religion, relatively skeptical of the Christian church's involvement in politics? If we're talking about individual parties adopting a denominational stance and adopting the doctrines of some specific denomination or group of denominations as a part of their party platform, then I think we have to view that in quite a negative way, and I think it's going to ultimately be the destruction of whichever political party does it, because it makes them sectarian and cuts them off from people, even other Christians, who don't necessarily agree with that particular denominational position or stance. At the same time, we saw in Eastern Europe and other parts of Europe how people would become Christian because it was the channel to political power. This certainly happened in Byzantium. It certainly happened in Russia, where people who didn't believe at all would become regular members of a parish church, and in order to advance their political goals. And they would advocate everything that the church taught in order to get those votes and in order to look like good Christians. From the time of Tsar Nicholas I, in order to hold a civil service job, you had to receive communion at least once a year in the Orthodox Church. Consequently, if you were a Jew who had a civil service job, you would receive communion in the Orthodox Church once a year. And, you know, we give communion by name. And one old priest, a bishop, told me a story once how a nobleman who stayed outside the country most of the time was a member of the Senate. When he came back in from France into Russia, hardly speaking Russian anymore, but wanted to take a seat in the Senate, he had to take communion because he hadn't taken communion once that year. So he went to Vespers hoping to take communion. Well, you can't take communion at Vespers, only it's a liturgy. So he showed up at the liturgy the next day with his valet and proceeded to come to the chalice, and the priest to give him communion asked his name, because and he didn't understand. So his valet said, "Oh, votre nom?" And he said, "Oh, sir, c'est vous?" In other words, he took it as an introduction. He didn't realize that he had to give his name to receive communion by name. So he simply took it as a formal introduction. So you have these kind of travesties that take place when you have a state church where the church becomes used as an avenue for political power. And you have it in democratic societies as well, where a person from a constituency of a dominant religious group will adopt that religion the same way that merchants do in order to make business contacts. And you know we have that in every denomination of the Christian faith, where people use a church as a place to make business contacts. And they also use it as an avenue for political power, especially if you can cultivate fear that will make people think you're the last hope and defender against whatever enemy they might concoct. You know, we can have many kinds of Kristallnacht. So this happens in every society where you have politics and where you have religion or philosophy. In an area where secularism or secular humanism is dominant, then it's to the profit of someone to be an outspoken secular humanist in order to gain votes. So if you're a politician, your first duty is to get elected. Your second duty is to stay elected. Your third duty is to have a good alibi. This is simply the way the political system works. But the great displacement in our society, which has a fabric which was woven in a Christian experience, if the Christian churches all decided to opt out of this involvement with civil society and with the governmental system, then a part of that fabric would be greatly weakened. A part of the roots and foundations of that society are undermined. And consequently, if for no other reason than that, we have to keep an involvement in civil society and realize that we have an obligation to civil society for the fabric of the society, which was founded upon the principles which we're still supposed to be, although we don't always, we're supposed to be still representing. And when we look at political policy, what we obviously don't have a unified voice within the Christian world. We have different perspectives on what we should intervene within government for, what different goals or what different matters should call forth our attempts to intervene. Joining one political party or staking our destiny in any one political party is, in my opinion, not a very wise thing to do, because you can never be sure that that political party is ever going to form a government or that it's ever going to have any kind of authority and power to do what you think ought to be done. As a matter of fact, most people in their first term as prime minister find out that no matter how sincere they were at making their promises, once they get there, they simply can't do it. They simply can't fulfill. Not because they necessarily didn't intend to and not because they were crooks, but they simply find out that there are forces, circumstances, and situations which prevent them from actually carrying it out. And we shouldn't think that all these people who become prime minister are just rankly dishonest. They simply find out that they can't do the things they thought they could do once they had power or authority. So we shouldn't, in my opinion anyway, I'm going to stress that, try to raise our flag over any one political party and say this is the answer, because we can be betrayed as quickly by the ones we trusted as the ones we mistrusted. So this is one of the problems in sorting it out. So we have to make our voice heard. We know that we're not going to have a unified voice in the Christian world, so we somehow have to decide, if we were going to decide as a whole community of variations on the Christian theme, about the things that we could move together on, I would say it would be to try to obey the two moral imperatives of Christ, which supersede the law. And that is to cherish and nourish our neighbor as ourselves, to care for our neighbor. And realize then that the only foundation stone for true morality is that morality consists far more in how well we care for one another than in what kind of behavior we try to impose on one another. That if we're not following that moral imperative, we have very little to say to society or to politics or to anyone round about us, because those are the moral imperatives that Christ imposed upon us as the root foundation and meaning of the law and the prophets. Upon these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. And, you know, we Christians are far more frequently quote the scripture when we want to hurt somebody than when we want to help somebody. That's one of our great tragedies in our age, as we always want to impose something on somebody. But we remember now that the Health Care Act, the Canada Health Care Act, what most people don't realize was that it was mandated by the First Ecumenical Council in 425. Universal free health care system. Two cousins of Apostle Paul founded the whole modern medical system. Two women, by the way, cousins of Apostle Paul, founded the whole modern medical system. Zenaida and Philonice, who were sisters of Jason, who was first bishop of Tarsus, who studied in the great Stoa at Tarsus under the disciples of Hippocrates of Kos, and purchased one of the privately owned mineral springs, where the general public couldn't go, of course, unless they were extraordinarily wealthy, and opened it up to the general public free, and began to follow the pattern of Hippocrates of Kos and try to develop scientific medicine. Filonella is credited as being the founder of the science of gynecology and spent most of her life trying to separate medicine and magic, to get magic out of the picture. And the other great mother of modern medicine was Hermione, who was the daughter of Philip the Deacon, she was also a New Testament prophet, by the way. And she founded the Xenodochia, the drop-in clinic, which were continued by Paula of Palestine and the two Saints Melanie after her. And so this St. Basil the Great, following the dictates of the First Ecumenical Council, built a hospital so large they called it the Basilia, the city of Basil. Justinian the Great, following the injunctions of the First Ecumenical Council, built the first modern hospital in Europe in Constantinople. And he went to the monastery and got the medical doctor, what we call the unmercenary physicians, this whole category of saints. Samson the guest receiver, Samson the hospitable, to design and build the first modern hospital. And he actually, following on the experience of Filonella, the cousin of Apostle Paul, conceived isolation wards for certain kinds of diseases that seemed to be passed from one person to another easily. But of course, didn't know anything about viruses and that sort of thing, because long way to the microscope. But anyway, this injunction for a universal free healthcare system was pronounced by the first ever General Assembly of the entire Christian Church. It was a spiritual, religious, and moral duty and obligation to provide a universal healthcare system. And this is the great gift of T.C. Douglas, the Baptist minister, who became... Only in my monastery, though. Only in my monastery. I think Tommy Douglas was the greatest Canadian that ever lived. But because the Canada Health Care Act is the greatest moral accomplishment in Canada, because we share the burden for one another. That's the whole essence of the Canada Health Care Act from a moral perspective. First of all, we fulfill our moral obligation to those who need, but we share the burden for one another. And the extra tax that we pay comes nowhere near the $1,000 a month that a family in the United States pays for medical insurance. You know, I had parishioners that we used to have to take up a couple of times. We took up a collection when my archdiocese went into the States as well to keep Americans from losing their homes because of their medical bills, because they have no means to purchase medical insurance. And they would be thrown out of their home. Their bank account and their car would be taken away from them before they could have access to any kind of medical help. So this is a great moral accomplishment in Canadian society, which came about because a small group of Baptist ministers were tired of seeing people lose their farms and their home and their life savings because of medical bills. And this was they were motivated by the Christian faith and their understanding of the Christian faith. Consequently, it's, in my view anyway, ludicrous to suggest that we as Christians should not try to change things, or that we should not try to influence the government. It's the things we try to influence the government about that are sometimes problematic. If we violate the moral imperatives of Christ in what we're trying to influence the government about, then we should announce that we're doing it because of an ideology of our own denomination and not on the basis of the moral imperatives of Christ. But the Christian faith in Canada is a part of the foundations of the fabric of this country, and when we withdraw completely, we pull the threads out of that fabric, and we leave it without a moral guide or direction. And existing within this society, we have an obligation not to try to, by compulsion, because compulsion has never saved the soul of anyone, but the free acceptance of Christ is necessary for their salvation. But we have, I think, an obligation to try to set a moral compass for society as a whole, without trying to demand that people accept our moral compass, but to try to convince people on the basis of its merits that it's a moral compass which is worth following. But by moral compass, I don't mean cold, dry, dead moralism. That we dictate the correct behavior of people according to our interpretation of it, but that we try to demonstrate what kind of society, what kind of fabric of society, what kind of community spirit, what kind of community sense actually can make a country a livable, safe, and sane place in which to live. Some people will be consumed by the right to life movement, but only one aspect of it. When we were protesting against the civil sanctions against Iraq, where 500 children a day were dying, we, myself and a group of people, approached some of the right to life people and asked them to join us in the protest. Well, we don't have anything to do with that, you know, that's, you know, Saddam Hussein and all that. Saddam Hussein's not dying. 500 children a day are dying. Saddam Hussein hasn't missed one lunch. No, this isn't our business. Well, why is it so bad to kill the unborn, but not so, but perfectly acceptable to kill the already born? You see, and nobody could answer that. So if you're going to cherish life at every stage and in all circumstances, you can't do it just in one circumstance and under one, in one particular area. You have to be concerned with the life of the world, the life of every human being on the face of the globe. You have to accept the fact that the tragedy of one country, the tragedy of one nation, the tragedy of one people is the tragedy of all of us. Because every living human being is the image and likeness of God, and we don't have a monopoly on the image and likeness just because we're Christians. Every human being is the image and likeness of God. Every child is the image and likeness of God. If I'm going to protest against abortion because of the right to life and stand by and watch thousands of children die and not protest and do anything, then I really should fold up my tent and crawl back into my hole. So we need to really look at how we're trying to influence the government and influence society. We get involved in the partisan politics of one party and pin all of our hopes on that, we're going to end up holding an empty bag in the end. We have to try to influence the whole system and all of the parties, because they're all sitting there. We have a minority government right now. What good would it be if we had a great deal of influence in the Liberal Party when any other party can outvote them or bring down the government? But when a political party itself ties itself to one particular corner of the Christian religion, then the political party is bound to suffer from that, because it's closed itself off from the others, made the others in a way afraid of it, and is following the ideology. Because you have a Christian faith, but you have many ideologies within that Christian faith, and those are ideologies, and they have to be recognized as ideologies. When, for example, a political party is going to tie itself to a group who wants to teach scientific creationism and ban the teaching of proper science from schools, when you have a political party that would insist that dinosaurs and humans live together at the same time, you know, or that you had every species of dinosaur on the ark, and so the dinosaurs were bigger than the ark, you know. We reckon that Noah could have done it by wearing a pair of binoculars backward, and when the dinosaur would appear very small, so he could pick it up with a pair of tweezers and put it on the ark, which would work as long as he kept the binoculars on backward. But really, when you get a political party that ties itself to that particular wing of the church, of the Christian faith, then it's a very negative impact overall for that political party. That's so it's negative for the Christian lobby, and we're a political lobby. We have to admit that, you know, we're not we don't have a hot wire to God. None of us has a, you know, still a long distance call for all of us. When we tie ourselves into one given political party, we limit our influence, we limit the range of our lobby, and when a political party ties itself to one wing of the Christian church, we are wings of the Christian church, you know, then they limit themselves also. So it's negative for the political party, and I want to suggest that it's negative for the religious body that ties itself to that particular political ideology, because political parties are about ideologies. There's no political party that's free of an ideology. Some of them are more clever at changing ideologies midstream sometimes. You hear all these promises before an election, and then after an election, when they see the way the wind was actually blowing, of course, they start switching ideologies. And I heard a story about Brian Mulroney and what's his name? Maude Barlow. Maude Barlow tells a story that she met, I was at a conference once where she was speaking, she met Brian Mulroney in Pearson Airport once, and she asked, this was when he was still in power, how he managed to stay in power, what he thought was the secret of political success. So he took her by the hands, they started dancing, and he said, it's all in how you dance. And she said, what do you mean? He said, little to the left, little to the right, little to the left and a little to the right. or as they say about Sheila Copps, one step forward, two steps back. So you can back a political party and suddenly find that they're shifting their ideology midstream, and you're left someplace out on some little island. So I think that really we need to be deeply involved in civil society and to embrace civil society. Civil society is not the enemy of our faith. Civil society is not anti-Christian per se. It's not anti-religious per se. You have ideological groups within civil society, but they don't represent civil society any more than any one denomination of the Christian church represents Christianity. And if we had the integrity to admit that our particular wing of the Christian church, or our particular brand of Christianity, or our particular point of view in Christianity represents only our own ideological group within Christianity, but doesn't represent the whole of the Christian faith. We have certain principles, the two moral imperatives of Christ. Then we can work to lobby to become an actual moral compass in society, offer what we think is the necessary moral compass, find out that when you get together with any large group of Christians, most of you are not going to agree with each other on about half the subjects you discuss. So we take that into consideration when we try to set this moral compass. And we set it on some kind of fundamental basic principles which don't go too far into our own hysterias, our own prejudices, our own neuroses, and all these other things that we develop as Christians, including us, you know. I mean, I'm not excluding the Orthodox Church at all. And to see what it is that we really need to try to move society toward. One thing we all have to do within each denomination of the Christian Church, within the Orthodox Church, within any given parish of the Orthodox Church, every one of us who thinks about our relationship to civil society and politics, if we can only open our eyes and our hearts and be honest with ourselves and see how much of what we think is our religious belief is shaped by our socio-political orientation and not by the faith itself. How much of it is shaped by the time and the place in which we were raised, where we were brought up, and how much of it is our own socio-political prejudice, and how much of it is actually about the Christian faith. And that's very important. And my first teacher, Father John Romanides, one time told us in a lecture, he liked to pause between these things so he could get over the shock first. He said, religion is a neurobiological illness. And then he paused for a little while and said, and faith is its only cure. And the trouble is that we're talking about religion impacting on society and political parties and not faith moving people toward, moving society toward, moving the political system toward the two moral imperatives of Christ. And that's what we essentially need to be doing. If you fulfill all the Ten Commandments because they're a law and you might be punished, it's good for society, but it does nothing for your soul. It has no bearing on your salvation whatsoever. It's not a moral deed at all. You filled it out of fear. It's simply self-preservation. If you don't kill because you love too much to kill, if you don't steal because you love your neighbor and would never hurt him from stealing from him, if you don't covet what your neighbor has but rejoice in what he has because you love him, then you fulfill the Ten Commandments. And it has some bearing on your salvation and on the condition of your soul and on the overall spiritual and moral condition of society. And we're never going to accomplish this kind of utopia. We're never going to be a holy nation, neither was Israel. I mean, Israel was a holy nation because it had a covenant relationship with God, not because the kings lived a moral life. And Lord knows the people hardly ever did. It was an on-again, off-again relationship with God, but they were still a holy nation because they were the spouse of the living God, because there was a spousal relationship between God and Israel. We're never going to be a holy nation by having this righteousness that everybody wants. We're never going to be righteous people, like the Pharisees always were, you know. Christ never spoke harshly to anyone except the righteous in society. He never condemned anyone except the righteous in society. Because the righteous were beyond hope. They couldn't repent of anything. This is what we have to look at when we try to influence the government and civil society. And the reason we have to be very careful about, we're accused of hypocrisy. Of course we're hypocrites. Because no one can ever live up to the highest standard that they set. And we always aim and aspire toward a higher standard. So we're always aiming at more than we can actually fulfill. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be looking to better ourselves, to improve ourselves. And when we start trying to interact in society as Christian people, we do need to be very careful and watch ourselves that we don't fall into a kind of bigotry and hypocrisy that drives people away from Jesus Christ and makes Christ something that is repulsive to people because of us who are claimed to be representing him. That's the last kind of charge I would leave. Now, I've expressed only my personal opinions about it, and I know what things I enter. You know, I'm the civil liaison for the Orthodox Church in Canada with the federal government, and I'm the mental health care critic for BC Ecumenical Council with the provincial government. So we do interact with the government in certain ways, but seldom publicly. Sometimes publicly when we feel there's an issue that we need to try to inform the public about. But we're trying to inform the public, not bully the public. And we're not trying to tie what we're trying to accomplish to any one political party. We're trying to get to the party in power because they're the ones who can do something about it. And we don't want to alienate ourselves from them by saying, we're your enemies and we're going to vote against you, we're going to campaign against you, but we want you to do this for us. That's my perspective on it, for what it's worth. And it's not worth any more than anybody else's perspective.